Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. If you would like, you could visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent five, are archived at the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. You know, at this time we're going to talk about the satisfaction of the participants in our workshop, our seminar, our mediation, whatever it is that we're doing, our community gathering. And it's rather important that people feel satisfied with the process because it will keep them interested. It will keep them coming back. It will keep them as participants because they feel that they're getting somewhere, right? They feel satisfied that the process is going forward, because otherwise sometimes it takes a while, doesn't it? And people get disgusted and they wander off. They're not satisfied. They go to a different group. They never get to the goal that they were hoping to achieve. All bad things. So satisfaction is indeed rather an important thing to foster, to work towards, that we all feel satisfied with the process. So I think our first question is going to be, what is satisfaction within this context? What's satisfaction? How do we get people to feel that they've had a satisfying experience? And, you know, a lot of this is, thank you for all of your participation. I see there's lots of you today. Thank you very much. And Barbara and others are saying that satisfaction is the feeling that you're being treated fairly. I think that's a very good point. That satisfaction is the feeling that you are being treated fairly. Yeah, that you're having a fair chance, that everybody is being treated as an equal. You know, and also as a corollary to that, Jeremy and others are saying that it's being treated respectfully. So being treated fairly, so that there's no preference given to one side or the other, because don't forget that we are impartial third parties usually. We are usually the host, the mediator, the person, well, the person kind of in charge, the leader. And everyone is more satisfied if they are treated respectfully. Respectfully. You know, people are saying, well, what's respectfully? Well, what do we think that is? Yes, it's being treated in a way that shows that your opinion is being honored. That you are of equal importance to the other people. That we want to hear what you're saying, right? That's all being treated respectfully. Yes. Laura and others are saying that satisfaction is when you reach understanding. That's towards the end, right? But you've reached an understanding. You've reached an accord. People using the word accord, an understanding, and a solution. Yes, thank you for all of your participation. So we've got being treated. What is satisfaction? Being treated fairly. Oh, yeah, I think that's very important, don't you? We get a lot of agreement. Being treated respectfully. And you have satisfaction when you've reached an understanding. And you know, of course, and people, there's a lot of agreement with that. Thank you for all of your participation. And of course, you know, an understanding gets reached within the process, right? It's not just the final goal. It's as we go step by step, as we push further, we get an understanding and we can go forward. It's kind of an underlying understanding, an agreement, an accord, and then we can go forward. We can go forward to the, well, to the conclusion, to the final understanding, right? Kim and others are saying that being treated respectfully is when all sides are being heard. You're being treated, we talked about what is respectfully, and you're being treated respectfully when all sides are allowed to be heard. Good point. Mm-hmm. That you're being treated fairly and everybody gets to say what they think. Mm-hmm. Claude and others are saying it's an acknowledgement of opinions. Right. I mean, we can have a discussion as to whether or not we think something is the right course of action. We can voice an opinion that is different than someone else's opinion. We can even have, well, some disagreement within the group. Oftentimes, that's why they've called us in, right? They've called in the third party because there is some disagreement within the group. And that's the acknowledgement, as Claude says, we have the acknowledgement of opinions. Mm-hmm. They all have validity. We're going to think about them. We're going to think about all of them. And we're going to then perhaps narrow this focus of the discussion to the ones that we think are the most workable as a group. But we're going to do this fairly, right, like Barbara and others said, and respectfully, which we just talked about, so that we can reach understanding, right? These are all leading to the same point of this makes it a more satisfying experience, right? And it is something that we are willing to repeat, willing to keep going to, willing to work at because we're getting somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Reed and others are saying that it's not only an acknowledgement of opinions, and thank you for all of your participation, it is being valued as a participant. Not just being somebody, oh yeah, you know, when you say something and then moving on and kind of ignoring you. No, being valued as a participant. Hmm. Good point. You have to feel that people are saying that you have to feel that it's worth your time, which will the process, the group, the meeting, the seminar, the workshop, it is worth your time, is what people are saying, that you should to make the effort to try to reach the accord, to try to reach a solution. Mm-hmm. And that's when you are treated fairly and you're valued as a participant, right? Right. And so now this leads us to the question that's being asked, and thank you very much for your participation. You know, these shows are kind of organic, aren't they? Because whatever we talk about is due to your questions and to what people would like to know is the next step. And so the next question that's being asked just generally is how can we encourage the creation of this participant satisfaction? Now, we've talked up until now, right, about the types of things that create satisfaction. Now, but we're a pragmatic group, right? We try to get down to a practical answer to something. And so the next question is, how can we encourage this creation of participant satisfaction? What can we do to make these things happen in a practical, workable manner? What an idea. Mm-hmm. And You know, this is an interesting point, and a lot of you are making it. Thank you for all of your participation. A lot of folks are talking about control in order to encourage the creation of participant satisfaction. Williams says that you maintain control of the process to prevent disrespect. If you see that something is getting a little out of the respect area, someone is being disrespectful, someone is, for example, raising their voice at someone else, this is interesting, people are saying that they don't generally have yelling or something, but people have body language, they roll their eyes and sigh really loud. Have you seen that? Of course you have. See, that's disrespectful. that is not valuing someone's opinion. And what can we do to encourage the creation of participant satisfaction? Well, as William says, we can maintain control of the process to prevent disrespect. You speak right up and you say that that is an appropriate behavior. You might say it in a little more joking way, if you know what I mean, because it's good to have people realize that they are acting in inappropriate behavior and allow them to fix it. Right, yes. And, yeah, a lot of people are talking about control. It's a real good point. It's the way to encourage creation of participant satisfaction is to not let the process go out of control, kind of run away with itself. I know that's an American idiom, and we are, of course, a global show. So, but it means to let things get out of hand so that it becomes uncomfortable. You won't get people to participate again if you allow such a thing to happen, will you? And I'm getting lots of interesting examples. Thank you for all of your examples. I'm getting lots of interesting examples of times when that kind of happened. And let's just say it's not a good idea, okay? It's not something that we want to have happen. So William says, maintain control of the process to prevent disrespect. And Dorothy says that you should maintain control so that everyone is allowed to participate. Sometimes if I see that I have a group that is reticent or only has a couple of talkers and everybody else kind of is sitting there and they look like they'd like to say something, but, well, gee, it's kind of hard to butt in and they're not very participatory, not very aggressive in a participation manner. And sometimes I'll call on people. Not to embarrass them. You see, the idea is not to call on them to catch them or something, but to call on everybody around the circle, so to speak, so that it's fair. Remember our concept of fair, and nobody feels embarrassed, but everybody has a chance to voice an opinion. And they know when their chance is coming up, right? Because we're going in a sequence. We're going around the room. So you can prepare and not be shocked and surprised. Because sometimes people are a little shy. They're not used to public speaking. So Dorothy and others say maintain control so that everyone is allowed to participate. Carl and others are making a good point, and it goes to the maintaining control and preventing disrespect of the process, of the people, of the room. Carl says that you prevent, in order to encourage creation of participant satisfaction, you prevent anyone from feeling like a loser. Good point. Because in our world, in the world of alternative dispute resolution and mediation, which is really what we're doing, right? Hopefully, everyone feels like they have won some and lost a little bit. But basically, it's a win-win. You try to make it so that nobody is a loser, as Carl puts it, and everyone feels that they have some satisfaction, that they can come away and talk to their group and tell people that they got somewhere, right? Nobody's a loser in these things. Quite a few people are using the word victimized. For example, Ida says you prevent, in order to create, encourage participant satisfaction, you prevent anyone from feeling victimized during the process. It's a question of respect and preventing bullying. You prevent anyone from feeling victimized during the process. Yeah, you know, sometimes some people have a tendency to try to get their way by being kind of louder. Yeah, I'm getting a lot of yeses and a lot of use of the word bullying. And that is someone who is louder, stronger, who victimizes somebody in the group and to force them to go over to their side, to the Well, people are calling this person a bully, and I suppose that's true. But yeah, Ida says that preventing anyone from feeling victimized during the process is a question of respect and preventing bullying. And of course, we want to stop that right away. We're not going to allow the process to become sidetracked in some sort of personality fight. Bad thing, yeah. So, now this is all well and good, but people, a lot of you, thank you for all of your participation. I've got quite a few questions asking about practical ways to create satisfaction so the participants will continue to work towards a successful outcome. And that's really the key to it, isn't it? Because people have to come back. We want them to keep working and to not go, oh, I had a bad time. Someone victimized me. My opinion wasn't heard. It'll keep people from coming back. We need them to come back and finish the job, yes. And so let's talk about practical ways to create this, what we're going to call satisfaction, so that the participants will continue to work towards a successful outcome. How do we actually do that? Yeah. How do we make it so? How do we get people, how do we create respect? How do we get people to come back to not feel victimized or bullied? Yes. And so what's the practical way? You know, Robert and others, and we've talked about this in prior shows. By the way, prior shows are archived on the website, the last five, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived to the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. So we're going to talk about this, and the reason I repeated where to find prior shows at that moment was we have talked rather more extensively about it. But it's a good point here. Robert and others are saying that a practical way to create satisfaction and make everybody feel like you're really getting somewhere. You know, I'm sure we've all been on committees, all been in groups, where it's like, that was a waste of time. And we don't want to, of course, host anything like that because it's not good. So, Robert and others are saying that you create a timeline as a group. Good point. As a group is a very good point because, yeah, the leader, somebody can make a timeline, but it's very subject to interpretation, isn't it? And to the practicalities of when something can be done. Yeah. And so creating a timeline as a group is a wonderful exercise. It's a wonderful exercise to get the group to start thinking in the same manner or thinking towards a solution. Because sometimes you haven't thought of it. Right. So let's create a timeline as a group and modify it as a group to prevent the process from getting stalled. That's a good way to have satisfaction, right? We keep going forward. Participants are happy. They're getting somewhere, right? Yeah. So create a timeline as a group and modify it as a group to prevent the process from getting stalled. Thank you. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you, Robert, for writing that so succinctly. Excellent. You know, this is an interesting point. So now we have a group participation where we would like to be in, well, it's your timeline, so you decide what the time increments are going to be. And yes, I'm going to say it depends again. People say I say that a lot. But it does indeed depend on the complexity of the issues and how long you project it's going to take to get a solution, to get an answer, to reach an accord, to reach an agreement. So the longer you think it's going to take, the longer the timeline, right? Right. And it does prevent the process from getting stalled because people can see visually where they are and where they thought they were going to be by this time. And that does make focus. It makes people get on the path. Yeah. And, you know, Yoko and others are saying that they do it the democratic way. It's a kind of a democratic idea in order to determine the next step. It's kind of scary. It's kind of, you have to judge your group, okay? They have to be basically like-minded, or this is not going to work real well. Yoko and others are saying that they have frequent polling, frequent voting, we'll call it. They frequently ask the opinion of the participants, and they vote on it. It's very, very democratic. It's great to determine the next step. Yeah, this is a lot of people are now asking if, thank you for all of your participation, if when you do a polling, a survey, a voting, yeah, people are going that they like that. And we have a lot of questions about anonymity, whether or not everyone should know how you voted. Kind of interesting. I personally, and I don't do the voting thing all the time because I do think it hinders some control over the group. We just talked about controlling the group, controlling the get-together, controlling the negotiation. And Yoko and others are saying that they frequently poll and they frequently vote to see the next step to go for the process. Yes, I think it's a wonderful idea. It has to be used with care because you could reach, if the group is not fairly close together in their opinions and about what you're doing and you're just trying to push people forward, if not, you could have a fight about the vote which sidelines the main issues. You see, I think it's a great idea depending on the group. I'm not real fond of activities that are liable to cause us to get off focus. And, you know, Bryce and others are saying the practical way to create satisfaction is to encourage feedback. Feedback to the group and privately. And I think feedback, sometimes it's okay to have anonymous, right? And someone should be in charge of looking at the feedback. Because quite frankly, if no one's in charge and no one's making a report and no one's kind of tallying whether or not the same basic idea comes up an awful lot in the feedback, maybe we should think about it out in the open. Maybe some changes should be made, some internal changes, so that the process would be more satisfying. Yes, somebody needs to look at that and report it to the leader, if it's not the leader that actually looks at it, because it's important to do feedback timely. Because otherwise, you go on and built on something that had negative feedback. Good point. Thank you for all of your participation. A lot of people are saying feedback is not necessarily negative. Very good point, because I kind of assumed it, didn't I? And that was wrong, because it's a good point. Feedback could be positive. You go, wow, that was a really good idea. I will keep that in the back of my mind, and I will try to do it as much as often, as much as possible, because people liked it. People thought it was a good idea. Yes, all good. So encourage feedback, both within the group, as in saying it out loud, and privately. I don't find anything wrong with a suggestion box. It doesn't have to physically be a box nowadays. Of course, it could be emails. But just a way to communicate and allow different kinds of thoughts that maybe this communication was not for the group, it was for, it was a process or a practical matter and not really an opinion about something. You see, not everything needs to be discussed for 20 minutes in the group. You know, Min and others, this is a very good point because nothing will make a group fall apart, an organization fall apart, any kind of a workshop, a seminar, anything to fall, nothing will make it fall apart worse than lack of communication, really just physical communication. When's the next meeting? What time is it? Give us plenty of time to calendar it. We're busy people. Mm-hmm. What do I need to bring? What do I need to do? What is my assignment? Who is going to collect the information? Who's going to collect the reservations? Who's going to be in charge of the actual logistics of the thing? Not just the physical logistics, but the communication logistics. Very, very important. Thank you, Min. I didn't think about saying that, but yes, I'm getting a lot of agreement and a lot of examples where a really good idea, a really good group, a really good way of making change imploded. It fell apart. It didn't get to the final outcome because no one was in charge of the logistics. Very important. Yeah, people are going, you have to have somebody in charge of how many chairs. That's a good point of who's coming. Yes, the logistics of it. Very good. Sakuna says that you need a designated person in charge of scheduling, group communication, and collection of information. A designated person, could be one volunteer, and it doesn't have to be the same person for all of these things, but it would be very helpful if they kind of were in communication with each other, right? Right. A designated person in charge of scheduling, group communication, and collection of information. Yes, so we all know where to turn it in, who to talk to. Just as simple a thing as I am coming or I've had an emergency and I'm not coming. Don't hold the discussion for me. Right, right. And, that's very important. Somebody in charge of logistics, they are the most valuable person of the group, I swear. And, you know, Eileen and others are making a good point here that you have more practical satisfaction with the process, with the group, with reaching the outcome. If you have also group agreement or at least discussion for the use of experts. Yes, I think that's very important. I think that experts is a very good, personally what I do is, if it's possible, and we are especially if we're paying an expert, I think that you should kind of get more than one option and then decide as a group which one you think would be the most beneficial. Mm-hmm. Maybe even talk to them, even on a speakerphone, so that you have an idea of what they think, what their style is, whether or not it will fit in. Yeah, very important. I suppose it's a logistic thing too, but it's a group agreement for the use of experts. Yeah, good point. Mm-hmm. This is interesting, too. I'm getting a lot of examples. Thank you for all of your participation that I'm going to call exclusionary. And Jennifer and others are saying that it is important for, as a practical matter, for creation of satisfaction, to not have exclusionary groups, to keep everybody in the loop. Oh, I know it's an American idiom, but it means to keep everybody, give everybody knowledge, tell everybody what's going on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes groups get kind of, they're not exactly a clique, but especially if you've got subcommittees and committees and people have worked with each other, but not so much with the group as a whole, they get a little exclusionary. And that's really bad because it makes resentment. And so it's important, indeed, as a practical matter, to group satisfaction, participant satisfaction, to not have little cliques that people are excluded from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We want to make a convivial atmosphere, right? We want everyone to feel welcomed, to feel that they are being treated fairly and respectfully, and that their opinion is of value. And we want somebody to be in charge of the logistics. It doesn't always have to be the same person, but if you're taking turns, people should know which turn is theirs. They should know in advance when they're doing it so that they can prepare, so they can be competent, right? Right. And so all of these things make for participant satisfaction. And yes, people are going, are you getting towards the convivial social networking idea? Yes. And of course, that's what Recipe for Peace Now advocates, right? We use mediation principles in addition to the fact that we actually have food, a potluck, a catered, whatever it is that you're doing, but food. And I've said this on prior shows, and I am going to say it again. Yes, thank you. People are writing down the sentence I'm about to say. Thank you for listening so carefully. But it's true that we use the food as a tool. It is not because we are hungry. I mean, it might be dinner time and we might be hungry, but that's not the real reason. Whenever you have a group of people, never mind anything else, that needs to be, to move forward with each other, needs to have some accord, yeah, needs to reach some agreement, there's going to be a point where somebody has to compromise. And the knee-jerk reaction to compromise is, no, let them do it. And if you let people out of the room in that no position, that idea will solidify, and you won't be able to change it. But if you keep them in the room, and there is a convivial atmosphere with some food, with some time out, with some, yes, I know it's an overworked word and people are using it and I'm going to use it too, with some networking, right? You get to know somebody as a person. You find out something you have in common, because you will. There'll be something that you have in common, even if it's only the local sports team. But there'll be something that you can talk about and be in agreement about. This makes a big difference when we have to compromise, when we have to get to the table again. So the food is a tool that makes a convivial atmosphere, and it does enhance participant satisfaction, because it's like going to a party. Instead of always being on, always being on the business, you get to have some relaxation, too, together. What a good idea. And so now that we've gotten to the food part, yes, I am going to say the other thing that I always say, and you can prove this by looking in the archive, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow, or the last five on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. But if you're going to have food, you will communicate, however it is you're communicating, with the whole group, and you will ask very important three questions. You will find out if anyone is allergic to something, has a dietary restriction, or has a religious restriction. We don't want anybody to be offended or have a bad time. So, the other thing we're going to do, and we're going to tell everyone in advance to do it, is we're going to label our food, not with the word of what it is, like meatloaf. No, we're going to label our food with a listing of the ingredients so that people can make a judgment as to whether or not they can eat it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those of you who have been here before, thank you for coming back. And welcome to everyone new. Welcome to everyone. And thank you for all of your participation. A lot of you know that I truly think also that since we are often the host, because we are the leader, the third party impartial, and if we're going to have food, I think we should bring a little extra, because I don't like to run out, and we need to have at least one safe recipe. Mm-hmm. Now, what what's a safe recipe? Yeah, people are starting to write it down. I know it's a rhetorical question to some of you. Thank you very much for always coming here. But a safe recipe is one that the participants are probably not allergic to, have a dietary restriction or religious prohibition. It doesn't have too many ingredients. And wherever you are in the world, and this is a global show, my participants would be familiar with the items in the recipe. Maybe it's not a safe recipe for you if your participants wouldn't be familiar, but that's what makes it safe. It's something that people have eaten before, and according to your survey, nobody has a dietary, religious, or allergic reaction to it. So here's our safe recipe this time. It's a real traditional spaghetti and meatballs. And I must confess that I am not fond of using long noodles, long pasta, like spaghetti or fettuccine or something in a group setting because I think it's messy. And really, people don't like to make a mess and it gets away from you. And you need an extra utensils and like that. I think everything goes on tube or pasta or bow ties or whatever you've got that is easier to handle and to get onto a serving utensil and to get to your plate and then to get to your mouth. So although this is called spaghetti and meatballs, I would often use a individual piece type pasta. Yeah, just because it's neater. Okay, so here we go. First, we're going to do the meatballs, right? We're going to have about 1.5 pounds of ground beef. This is my safe recipe, so I'm making it beef. And, yes, you can use lamb. People are already asking about lamb. And people ask about pork, too. And, yes, if there was no prohibition and I was positive, because pork is tricky, I like half pork, half beef just because I think it's more delicious. But beef will do. And so we've got 1.5 pounds of ground beef, about 3/4 cup of breadcrumbs, very fine breadcrumbs, yes. In the States where I am, it is very readily available and quite inexpensive to buy breadcrumbs in a canister, in a what's not really a can or a jar, but it's a paper canister, but to buy pre-made breadcrumbs. These pre-made breadcrumbs are oftentimes, for the same price, you can get them flavored. Personally speaking, I like the Italian flavor. So flavored breadcrumbs are great in this because it adds another depth of yumminess. If you don't have it, you want to make your own, go for it. But I'm going to use flavored, actual commercial breadcrumbs, 3/4 cup. A nice big onion we're going to finely chop. 3 garlic cloves crushed. People say I use a lot of garlic. You think that's true, use less. I'm going to use something that is not a terrible traditional in this, but I think it gives it another lovely depth of flavor, and you need the little bit of moisture. About 3 teaspoons of ketchup. Mm-hmm. I think it's delicious. People use other flavorings. I'm already getting questions about Worcestershire sauce and Tabasco sauce. The answer to Tabasco and anything that is quite spicy like that is know your audience. Because in my neck of the woods, in my area, using Tabasco sauce like that would disqualify this from safe recipe because it would make it quite spicy. I'm going to use ketchup. You can use as you please. 1 teaspoon of parsley. All chopped up real nice and fine just because it looks pretty in the meatballs and it's delicious. We're going to have about 1/4 cup of just regular flour, plain flour, because we're going to coat the meatballs, and 2 tablespoons of oil, of olive oil. So, shall we do the meatballs first? I think we should. Should we give, you guys want the sauce ingredients first? Yes, you're writing it down like that. People are saying that they would like all the ingredients up front. So that's the meatball ingredients. Now let's go for the sauce ingredients. I'm going to use 2 big cans of chopped tomatoes. We all know that I'm going to use the can of tomatoes. It is inexpensive, readily available, and it's a big convenience. And it, out in this area, if you use regular tomatoes and you want to chop them up and dice them in like that, yours will come out better than mine, so go for it. A tablespoon of olive oil. We're doing the sauce now, right? Another onion, a big onion, finely chopped. 2 garlic cloves crushed. Yes, I like garlic, I know. About 3 tablespoons of tomato paste. A scant 1/2 cup of beef stock, because you have to kind of look at it and make sure it's not too runny. And I do like sugar in it. Yes, I know. I claim to put sugar and garlic in lots of things where sugar and garlic don't traditionally go. I think it gives it a nice little tweak of the flavor. I'm going to use 2 teaspoons of sugar. Tablespoon of sugar. Just one. And then we're going to have 1.5 pounds, maybe closer to 2 pounds, of pasta that we're, of course, going to cook and drain. Cook al dente, cook kind of firmly and drain. Yeah. So we'll put that aside. So that's our ingredients. Now let's make our meatballs, right? We're going to combine the ground meat, the breadcrumbs, the onion, the garlic, the ketchup, and the parsley in a bowl, a pot, whatever you've got, whatever will hold it, and we're going to mix it all together. Quite frankly, just use your hands. I've seen people try to use like a big slotted spoon or something doing this. Ah, gee, use your hands. If you just can't take the texture, I suppose you could use something that incorporates it, a knife or something, but I just squish it with my hands. And we're going to take this lovely meat mixture that we now have, which is really meatballs, right? It's all done. It's all rolled together. The moist is in and the breadcrumbs are in and everything. And we're going, people are asking me what kind of meat. I digress. Some with a little bit of fat. I like 85-15 ground chuck, because that is readily available to me, and it's a mixture that we've got here. But don't take out all the fat on the meatballs. I digressed, yes. Yes, you can use an inexpensive cut. So we've got this nice mixture with the meat. We're going to take it, and we're going to moisten our hands, and we're going to roll it into little balls, meatball size. You know what I mean, of golf ball size. You know what I mean, not a huge one, smallish meatballs. And we're going to dust the whole thing with some flour, and we're going to shake off the excess. We're not going to really roll it in the flour, because we want to have a little bit of a coating because it's going into the pan. We're going to heat the oil in a nice deep frying pan, and we're going to cook our balls in batches, turning them around so that they brown evenly. Do not skimp on this step, because otherwise your meatballs will fall apart. It kind of gives them a little bit of a crust, a little bit of browning, so that they are firm. Yeah, okay. So we've got the meatballs done. They're delicious. They're wonderful. They've been turned. They are evenly browned. We're going to drain them on a dish, on a paper towel, if you've got paper towels, whatever it is that you want to drain them on. So they're done. The meatballs are yummy. They're sitting to the side. They're sitting next to the pasta, come to think of it. So we're going to make the sauce, right? We're going to take our tomatoes, and we're going to give them a little more chopping. And we're going to heat the oil in the pan because we want to make them into the sauce, right? And we're going to heat our other oil, our 2 tablespoons of oil, right? And we're going to heat that in a frying pan. And we're going to add the onion. We're going to cook it for a few minutes. Add the garlic, another minute more. Add the tomatoes, the tomato paste, the stock. Not too much stock. You'll look at it and see how you feel about it. And the sugar. And we're going to stir it all around. It's already got the garlic and the onion cooked. It's already hot. It is all stirred together. We're going to bring the whole thing to the boil because we've got sauce. We can look at it. It's delicious already. Now we're going to add our meatballs to the sauce, reduce the heat, and simmer the whole thing for about 15 minutes. So that the meatballs get incorporated into the sauce. Everything's nice and hot, and you're reducing down some of the liquid, right? Right. simmer the whole thing for about 15 minutes. If your meatballs should be covered with the sauce. If they're not, you're going to want to turn them maybe twice just to keep them from getting that hard, dry edge to them because it was outside of the sauce. Yeah, try to use a pan that covers them. People are asking about turning the meatballs. Try to use a pan where they're covered in the sauce, and then you'll just have to, like, stir it through, turn them once.
Yeah.
So, there we've got it. We've got magnificent sauce. We've got our delicious meatballs in it. We've got our pasta, which we're going to reheat because it got kind of cold sitting to the side. And we're going to spoon out the pasta. We're going to spoon the sauce and the meatballs on top. All wonderful. All good. And yes, if you'd like, you can top it with some cheese because people are asking about that. Yes. And so there we have it. It is easy to do. Everybody likes it. Over in this area, it is the safe recipe because it has very few ingredients and people can see the ingredients also. That's important. A lot of people are getting a lot of feedback that a lot of people are allergic to tomatoes. Yes, you would have taken your survey. You would know if you have someone allergic to tomatoes. And not only are they labeled, right, we're going to label everything, but you can really see them. If you're allergic to tomatoes and you eat tomato sauce like that, you see the tomatoes. Excuse me, just took a little sip of water there. So, that is our safe recipe. Not too many ingredients, very common where I am, and it is actually kind of easy to do. It's delicious. It's a real crowd pleaser. And yes, people are asking if I would serve it separately from the pasta. I kind of like to. If I'm going to have a potluck with like a buffet where everything is out, I tend to put the pasta in a big bowl by itself and the sauce and meatballs next to it so that people can choose how much to put on the pasta or whether they want the meatballs or not. You know what I mean? It gives people a choice. So, yeah, I do think that that's neater, and that's partially why I think that long noodles are a really bad idea. It's too messy. It's too hard to control how much you're taking. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people want to taste stuff first, which is good. Mm-hmm. So, now on to our adventure recipe. This is an adventure recipe because it has ham, for one thing. Ham's pork. A lot of people have a religious or dietary prohibition. Also eggs. Really seriously, eggs, not just eggs as an ingredient in the pasta, which is, you can get pasta that doesn't have an egg ingredient, but you know what I mean, they're actually in there. And so this is our adventure recipe, right? Right. So let's think about this. I actually got this recipe from someone who came to one of the potlucks with it, and we all went, wow, is that cool and really delicious. It sounds messy, but it's not, because we're going to bake it so that the egg and everything is firm, and it scoops out. It's really delicious, and it's easy to serve. So let's think about this. It's a ham and pepper and egg dish with the ham and the peppers incorporated underneath the eggs. People are asking, like, corned beef hash. I guess so. Kind of underneath, and then the eggs are put on the top and baked. Well, let's talk about it. Let's do it. So we're going to have a couple tablespoons of olive oil, an onion that we're going to chop up. I think 2 garlic cloves goes in everything, I swear. So we've got our 2 garlic cloves finely chopped. About 1/2 pound of cooked ham cubed. I like to give kind of good portions, so I'm going to say more, like 3/4 pound to 1 pound. I really like to have enough. So let's put 1 pound of ham cubed in there, cooked, all cooked. Around here, you could just buy it like that, in all truth and honesty. And this is a good leftover dish. You can indeed use turkey. Please be careful with leftovers, of course, that you don't make anybody sick. You know, don't refrigerate them properly and don't use something that's really past date, as they say. But, yeah, it's kind of cool for leftover meat in that respect, either ham or turkey. We usually have leftover chicken, but around in this, in the United States, this is kind of holiday time and turkeys. There's a lot of turkey hanging around. So let's use a whole pound of ham, cooked ham cube or turkey, whatever you've got. Two bell peppers that we're going to seed and core and thinly sliced. We're going to do the same with two yellow ones. We're going to seed them and core them and thinly slice them. We're going to use another big can of tomatoes. Oh, yeah, I can't help it. I am going to use them. The chopped kind's fine. We're going to drain it. About a 16-ounce can. A tablespoon, make it two tablespoons, of tomato paste. And at least six large eggs. Mm-hmm. And a cup of cheddar cheese, of grated cheddar cheese. So, you think I'm going to put the eggs inside. I am not. Here we go. We're going to heat the oil in a frying pan. We're going to add onion and the garlic. We're going to cook them for what? About 3-4 minutes until they get nice and fragrant and translucent and it's all yummy but not browned, if you know what I mean. And so 3 minutes later, there we've got it. Now we're going to add our pepper, our slices of pepper to the pan. And we're going to cook that for another maybe 3-4 minutes, too, until they get all nice and softened. You might have to add a little bit of oil, depending on how it's looking. And you want to get them softened and cooked through, but not squishy. So just beginning to soften. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to stir in the tomatoes, the tomato paste, and our meat, the ham. We're going to use ham in this one. We're going to put a little... Well, put a little salt, but ham's usually salty. And we're going to take this whole thing, and now it's got the liquid in it, and it's got the tomatoes and everything. And we're going to look at it and see if it's thick enough, and it will be, I think. And we're going to turn the heat down, and we're going to simmer it for about 15 minutes so that everything gets incorporated and the peppers get nice and soft and delicious and everything. It's all making a delicious base. Mm-hmm. So we're simmering it for about 15 minutes. You have to. People ask me if you have to stir it. Not frequently. I'm afraid that unless there's a specific reason why not to, I give everything a stir in the middle of the cooking, just so that it doesn't stick to the bottom, and I know that it's all incorporated properly, and I don't have hot spots and cooler spots in the food. So we're going to reduce the heat to low, and we're going to take our six eggs, and we're going to make with a spoon in the vegetable mixture, we're going to make kind of six little indentations. And we're going to put an egg in each indentation, just on the top. We are not going to scramble them or anything. We're just going to put them, the yolk and everything, in the six indentations in a circle in the pan. Mm-hmm. So we're going to continue to cook them over this low heat until the white starts to set. The white part of the egg starts to set and turn white. Now we're going to turn on the broiler, right? Because we're going to take this entire thing, eggs that have just cooked, the whites have turned white. But you know what I mean. When the eggs come out of the shell, the whites aren't white. They are clear. And when they turn white, and it all looks nice and cooked through. We're going to put the cheese over the mixture, spread the cheese all over, and stick it under the hot broiler for about 5 minutes because we're setting the eggs and melting the cheese. Oh, yummy! Yes! It's ham and cheese and vegetables and eggs, and it's not really for breakfast, although it could be. People are going, that's a brunch item. Well, yeah, you know, there's nothing that says that you have to do your negotiations, do your meetings at dinner time. Mm-hmm. It might be earlier in the day. It might be brunch. Or, you know what, this is delicious. You could eat it any time. I don't have a real concept that eggs are only for breakfast or brunch or something, because why should they be? They're yummy at all times. Yes. So that's it. That's our adventure recipe. Why is it an adventure recipe? Because it has ham, unless you decide to use something else. Remember, it needs to be cooked. And it has eggs, which some people do not eat because cholesterol and things. You know, Americans worry about it more than anybody else. And it's going to be labeled. And it's our adventure recipe because of the pork, mainly. Mm-hmm. Yes. And there we have it, all done. And it's surprisingly pretty, too, if I may say so, about the ham and pepper and egg dish with the eggs on top and the cheese and everything. And it cuts really nicely. Mm-hmm. Yes. So there we have it. And I see that our time together is nearly up. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for coming. Thank you for all of your participation. It's lovely to hear from you. And if you would like to contact us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. And the last five shows are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five shows, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for listening. I always learn something when we do these shows, and I hope you do too. Thank you for coming, and please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.